Today at Reader's Corner, Jacob Hacker, author of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For much of the 20th century, private and public enterprises worked as both partners and adversaries to drive economic growth in our country. But in recent years, the balance within this so-called mixed economy has shifted away from public investment and regulation. Today, the term big government is widely considered a pejorative, despite the role public institutions have historically played in laying the foundation for social development and prosperity. In a new book titled American Amnesia, political scientists Jacob S. Hacker and Paul Pearson take issue with what they describe as a war on government. In the book's introduction, they note that American amnesia is about an uncomfortable truth, that it takes government, a lot of government, for advanced societies to flourish. Today we're speaking with one of the book's two authors, Jacob Hacker. He is director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University. This is the third book Dr. Hacker has written with his colleague and co-author, Paul Pearson, who is at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Hacker joins us today from the studios at Yale University. Jacob Hacker, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Jacob, if there's one book that I could recommend that Americans should read this year, this would be it. All 369 pages. We're going to try to cover that here today.
The first part was good for getting people to read it. The second part may be a little bit less good.
Well, I'm really excited about the book. And what you have done to make this easy for us is that you've divided this book very neatly into two parts. The first one explaining the rise of the mixed economy, as you call it, which we can discuss this week. And then next week, we can come back and cover the erosion and the current crisis of the mixed economy. So let's just kick it off with a little example you used of how different things are today than they used to be by pointing out that American amnesia took hold between the two Romneys, between George Romney and Mitt Romney. Explain how that fits into your thesis in this book.
Yeah, well, if you go back to George Romney's political career, which reached its peak in the 1960s, you would see a political figure very different from Mitt Romney. The two shared a name. They both also were blue state governors from states that leaned to the Democratic Party. George Romney was the governor of Michigan. Mitt Romney, of course, the governor of Massachusetts. And you know, both of them were business leaders in different ways. Mitt Romney was, of course, the founder of Bain Capital, an investment firm, and his father George was an old industrial pioneer in the auto industry and actually led the auto industry's trade group. So here you have two figures who are kind of the moderate establishment part of their party, but they're totally different in the way that they think about the economy, in the way that they think about the Republican Party, and in the way that they lead the private business enterprises they run. So George Romney was really a mixed economy mandarin, if you will. And when we say the mixed economy, we'll talk more about it. We really mean a system in which government has an important role to play alongside the private sector in promoting prosperity. So George Romney expanded education programs. He was very supportive of labor unions. He, in fact, helped labor unions mobilize within his own state, the first public sector unions that were forming in Michigan. He was very supportive of the kind of moderate government role that other Republicans like Eisenhower and actually Richard Nixon supported. And as a business leader, he really saw himself as a member of a community. He was in the auto industry. It was centered in the industrial Midwest. He saw labor unions as stakeholders. He worked closely with labor leaders, even though they sometimes had acrimonious relationships. So in all these respects, he was really quite different from what was to come in the Republican Party. And in fact, he saw what was happening, and he said that Goldwater, who represented the right wing of the party at the time, was going to lead to a fragmented and atomized political system in which polarization was going to get in the way of getting things done. So fast forward to his son, Mitt Romney. Mitt is also Republican, also in a blue state, and also, I think, really in the mainstream of, and maybe to the left of the mainstream of his own party. But in his political positions, he adopts a pretty hard conservative line, particularly when he's running for president of the United States in 2012. He even says, "I'm severely conservative," which no severe conservatives actually believed. But it was a sign of what he felt he had to do to win, and he made a statement that really haunted him, right, that government dependency affected 47% of Americans who didn't pay federal income taxes. You know, that was a kind of statement that George Romney and Republicans in the mid-20th century never would have made. It was political suicide. And then lastly, as a business leader, you know, his firm was a private equity firm, and what it did basically was buy companies and resell them, slice and dice, and treat them basically as commodities that could be divvied up and reparceled and resold. And I'm not sitting here judging exactly how good private equity is, but it's fundamentally different from the kind of old industrial economy. And so that's the story we tell. It's basically, how did we move from an economy in which corporate leaders saw themselves as embedded in the community, in the nation, and were constructive partners in building government policies, to a world in which you had private equity billionaires, people like Mitt Romney, who were pushing for a much more conservative line? And how did we move from a world in which the Republican Party was basically a moderate alternative to the Democrats to one in which it presented a kind of radical conservative alternative, one that is increasingly, at least prior to Donald Trump's ascendance, leaned heavily libertarian? That is, it was heavily anti-government, talked about the virtues of capitalism unregulated and unmolested by the heavy hand of government authority.
And speaking of the virtues of capitalism, for those of us that still remember at least one economics course we taught, when you got to the argument that government ought to stay out of the marketplace, somewhere along the way you were given Adam Smith as the perfect example, the invisible hand running through the marketplace, regulating things so well that there need not be any role for government. But you point out in your book that Adam Smith, like a lot of us, had another hand.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are two sets of intellectual figures whom we think you really need to understand if you want to understand why modern capitalism works. One are those theorists who thought about how economies work and how they sometimes don't work, and Adam Smith was one of them. The other group, a group that we also, I think, misunderstand today, were the founders of our nation and those who built the mixed economy in the subsequent decades. So focusing on the first group and Adam Smith, we remember his metaphor of the invisible hand, the idea that the self-interest of individuals will allow, through the kind of information that gets revealed in prices and the exchanges that take place in the market and the division of labor that results, will result in prosperity. But Adam Smith actually has another side, which was very enthusiastic about, well, we should just call it, I guess, the visible hand of government. He didn't think financial markets, for example, would work well without regulation. He was a big fan of taxes. He said that taxes were a badge of liberty. You don't really see many libertarians who cite Adam Smith quoting that. And perhaps most important, he was really very strongly of the view that what mattered was that you had a government that was independent enough of those who were making profits, of merchants, as they called them at the time, that it could actually regulate on behalf of the public good. So at one point he said, you know, when regulation is in the favor of the workman, right, in the favor of the ordinary people who benefit from that regulation, it is always just and equitable. Always just and equitable. I mean, this again is, you know, regulation when it's in favor of workers is always just and equitable. It sounds more like, I don't know, Karl Marx than Adam Smith. So the point is that we misunderstand Smith. We misunderstand the sort of foundations of modern economies when we think that those who understood the power of capitalism didn't also appreciate that you needed to have significant public authority, not just to get markets to work in the first place, which is really important, but also to make sure that over time that markets and government could remain independent enough that you could respond to what's happening in the market. If there's pollution, you don't want the corporation to decide whether or not there should be regulations to limit that pollution. And so too with financial markets that are spewing out toxic assets rather than toxic air. So that was the fundamental idea of Smith that we wanted people to understand. And behind it is just this very basic idea that we describe in the book, that in a complex, interdependent society, markets inevitably come up short, particularly when the behavior of these profit-seeking market actors undermines or leads to social outcomes that nobody wants, whether it's pollution or undermining our democracy. Those kind of what economists call externalities are at the heart of the story we tell. And really the rise of modern capitalism, the way in which we cross this huge divide between poverty and ill health and illiteracy to one of widespread mass prosperity, long lives, and high levels of education is a story of an effective partnership between the market and government, not a jealous rivalry.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Jacob Hacker, author of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. You mentioned the founding fathers. Jefferson, of course, is often quoted as that government which governs best governs least, and I guess we don't really even know whether he really said that. But you go on to talk about Jeffersonian rhetoric and Jeffersonian action. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in practice, as you would know if you've seen the musical, Hamilton the musical, where Hamilton sort of outmaneuvers Jefferson in rap form in the musical. In practice, Jefferson really found it difficult to unwind Hamiltonian policies and, in fact, ultimately embraced some of them. I mean, to us, there's several examples. He wasn't able to get rid of the National Bank. He continued the policies of infrastructure investment. But there's an example that I think all of us remember from our high school history class, the Louisiana Purchase, which is really an amazing example of federal economic development, where we just acquired an enormous tract of land, roughly as equal in size to the existing United States, and that became a cornerstone of our long-term economic expansion. Essentially, our move westward, the expansion of new markets, was just a fundamental feature of the American economic story. Now, the truth is that all of the founders, Jefferson included, were skeptical of government because they had experienced tyrannical government under the king, but they were also trying to get away from a failed experiment in government that we often forget. So the story of the Constitution that most of us know is that, you know, there was the Revolution and then, like Seinfeld style, yada, 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 Constitution, right? It just happened. But in fact, that yada, yada, yada was a really important period. We had a decentralized Articles of Confederation that simply lacked the ability to do the things that a national state needed to do, defend the United States and regulate commerce. And as a result, all of the founders who came to Philadelphia and risked their political futures and perhaps their lives to get a constitution, they all wanted to create a stronger central government. And so it's a mistake to see, you know, the national government as a kind of repudiation of the founders' ideals, as so many conservatives now display it. It was an embodiment of those ideals. Now, it's evolved in its particular direction, a direction that Paul Pearson, my co-author, and I think was necessary for economic development. But its foundation was in this constitutional settlement that said we need to have a strong, effective national government if we're going to have a strong economy and a vibrant and continuing nation.
In making your case for how America became a rich and prosperous nation, you cite the 10 habits of highly effective economies, and you point specifically to the East Asian miracle. That seems to fit in a way with what you're just saying about the way America got off the ground.
Absolutely. I mean, so, you know, it's a play, of course, on the 7 habits of highly effective people.
Right.
I couldn't get it down to 7, but we have these 10 examples of things that you really need to have, and they all involve government. And I won't go through them specifically, but I'll talk about a few that I think are really important that that we tend to forget. So the first thing that I think is really fundamental is that until the late 19th century and early 20th centuries, we were a country in which people lived very short lives, on average at the end of the 19th century, 45 years. And a big thing that government did that created our prosperity was essentially clean up the environment, particularly water that we were drinking, in a way that allowed us to be productive citizens. So life expectancy, of course, then grew dramatically. And most of the growth in the earliest 20th century was basically about making cities livable. So that was a huge part of our economic growth. Another thing that governments do is invest in education. And that's makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Most people are not able to and don't have the incentives to invest adequately in the education of their children. They're not going to just wake up one day and create a public school. That's why the United States as the pioneer and the creator of education, with public education extending to all citizens in the 19th century, well before it extended, or all white citizens, I should say, in the 19th century, well before it extended to all citizens in other countries, that was such a fundamental part of American economic growth. And it continued in the 20th century with the United States' pioneering role in creating universal high school education, and then its role with the GI Bill and other policies of expanding college education so that we were the most educated people in the world. So those two examples, I think, really drive home that a lot of what government does, a lot of those 10 habits of highly effective economies, involve the kind of basic investments in the kind of fuel for economic growth, not the kinds of redistributive policies that most critics of government focus on. And I'm not saying those policies aren't important, but we often forget just how important these other kind of fundamental policies are. And the East Asian story and the U.S. story intersect in this really amazing moment in the mid-20th century when the United States essentially turned its national political and policy efforts towards creating an advanced economy. And it was, of course, driven in part by the desire to win World War II, but there was a larger vision there. And we write about a MIT scientist named Vannevar Bush, who is now forgotten, but in the mid-20th century was known by almost everyone because he had led the Manhattan Project. He was the key person in the Defense Department who was overseeing the investments in science and higher education. And after World War II, he basically said, we need to invest in these public goods in a way that no other nation has. And the United States did. We were spending more on research and development than all other governments and businesses in the world combined in this period. And it fueled, it fueled the giant advances in computer technology that led the United States to be the leading technological power and still the leading technological power in the world. So that, to me, is a perfect example of our sort of East Asian story of state-promoted but not state-led growth.
You know, you mentioned Vannevar Bush. I'm reminded at the tail end of your book, you point out, and it's a very interesting way to say it, you say something like, basically, somehow, some way, we have airbrushed the role of government out of this mixed economy, out of our American history. And you point to a recent movie, The Bridge of Spies. But you point out Vannevar Bush is a guy who, in a sense, plays a role we don't learn about in the movie because, as it turns out, the hero of this book worked for him one time. And it gets us to the point of what role the federal government played in research and development, in R&D over the years, right on down to the present-day Department of Defense and the role it played in the life of the computer, the internet, and go on from there.
That's absolutely true. And so, as we point out in the book, the hero of this movie, who's played by Tom Hanks, as all heroes should be, is portrayed as this kind of insurance lawyer, everyman insurance lawyer. And in fact, he was one of Vannevar Bush's key employees. He was at Nuremberg. He was very much within government. And what we thought is about this is that it's very revealing that a movie that's about such a central public figure and who has a bunch of, and the movie has a bunch of government officials in it. They're all bumbling CIA guys. that a movie about such a central public figure basically and done by, a well-known liberal basically right. decides that no one's going to be that interested in or maybe even buy that government was a big part of the story. And so I think that's really that's getting to the second part of this larger narrative we tell about the collapse or crisis of the mixed economy. But it's very revealing that this period is one in which we really saw the fastest economic growth and productivity in our history, and government was absolutely central to it, is one that we tend to remember through this gauzy vision where we forget just how much all of the major players accepted a substantial role for government alongside the markets. And that's really the story of Mitt Romney and George Romney, right? So George Romney doesn't seem exceptional at the time he's running for the presidency. He, of course, doesn't get the nomination of the Republican Party, but he's not exceptional. All of the Republican leaders and most Republicans in Congress were fairly moderate. And the business community that George Romney represented wasn't that exceptional either. Business leaders were generally pretty moderate, and the organizations that represented them, moreover, were generally pretty moderate and willing to work with public officials to use government constructively. And so there are big forces behind the shift that we're talking about away from using government to promote prosperity. But I think one of the most fundamental is that we have sort of forgotten essentially how important this role was and is. And a last thing to say there is that it's very hard for people to think about a mixed economy. I mean, I do think that all of our visions of how capitalism works are based on this idea of the heroic entrepreneur and the, you know, freely functioning invisible hand of the market. And the reality is that if you look at how markets actually operate, they involve large organizations. They involve lots of public investments that make that entrepreneurship possible. And they involve regulation and supplementation by government. And that's all the more true as economies become more complex and knowledge-oriented, as they have over the 20th century. And so we ignore this history at our peril because right now, if you look at our economy, it really needs us to recapture that spirit of public investment and well-functioning public authority. And I'm not saying that'll be easy, but I think a really big part of recapturing that is thinking about how do you construct a new mixed economy, a different mixed economy for the 21st century that really involves that essential partnership. This isn't a relationship of mutual animosity or conflict. It's one of constructive, sometimes acrimonious, but constructive exchange.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Jacob Hacker, a professor at Yale University and the co-author with Paul Pearson of American Amnesia. So remind us of President Nixon's role as a leader of the mixed economy, perhaps the last one to embrace it.
So Nixon is another misunderstood figure. He obviously was embracing a much more conservative electoral strategy in 1972, and he was really seeking out Southern Democrats, trying to get them to shift over into the Republican Party. And so a lot of his rhetoric was very divisive and dare I say it, embodied some pretty significant amounts of coded racial appeals. But his policymaking, what he actually did in office, was really a continuation of what had happened under Johnson and Kennedy. And it was a policymaking process that reached toward the middle and that tried to build on the mixed economy rather than tear it down. So Nixon creates the modern environmental regulatory system with the Clean Air Act, and he creates consumer product safety regulations, occupational health and safety regulations. He massively expands Social Security. You could go down the list. Yes, exactly. So in a lot of ways, when conservatives rail against the regulatory state, they're really railing against things that Richard Nixon and the Congress that he worked with created. And it's really in the 70s that we see this shift against a mixed economy. So as late as the early 1970s, when Richard Nixon is governing and before Watergate, you were continuing to see the mixed economy be refined and enlarged. Social Security, as I said, was expanded. The president supported significant investments in higher education, and lots was happening at the state and local level that was in the same vein. So something happened in the 1970s, actually under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter, that really shifted the tone and direction of the discussion about the mixed economy.
Do I remember in your book that you refer to Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, or at least to Hayek, and point out that this guy who is oftentimes used by those who want government to get out of the way of the free market actually believed in social insurance of some kind?
Yeah, there's this great line from Hayek in his book, The Road to Serfdom, where he says, by the way, I just completely accept that there's an important role for government in providing social insurance, including health care and old age insurance, so which is basically all of the Social Security Act and the National Health Program that Truman was trying to get into the Social Security Act at the time that Hayek was writing. So I think that's important because although Hayek is a powerful figure in shaping this conservative reaction against government, he was really responding as was Eisenhower, and to some extent Vannevar Bush, to the most liberal, most centralizing tendencies at the present moment that he was writing. And so in retrospect, what is striking is how moderate many of the conservative critiques were. They really were worried about not about the role of government, but about state planning. They didn't like the idea of the government trying to direct far-flung decentralized markets. And you know what? They actually had a pretty good point, right? That's not really where government thrives. And in Vannevar Bush, for example, he didn't want government doing the science. He wanted massive investments in private research institutions, including universities and private businesses that were doing that research, with accountability to government and with direction from government that ensured that the investments were taking place in the areas that would have the greatest public benefit. So this is the point we're making, is that at this mid-20th century moment, there was a balanced politics that had an important role for government and the private sector, important role for conservatives and progressives, and an important role for business and labor. And that balance has been lost. And as a result, we've lost some of the underlying dynamism and investment that really makes prosperity possible.
I glossed over the issue of the internet and the computer. Could you just address the role that the U.S. Department of Defense played in these developments?
Yeah, I mean, the role that the federal government played in promoting computing technology was so large that it almost sort of defies description. But you can get a picture of it by looking at the story of Andy Grove, the CEO of Intel. And it's revealing that when Grove died just recently, there was very little commentary on how important government had been to the industry in which he worked and to his own rise. And that was all the more striking because Grove himself constantly talked about this. So Grove came to the United States as an emigre. He went to City College in New York, and there he gained the sort of basic training he needed to go to Berkeley, another public university, where he gained advanced training as an engineer. And then he went to a semiconductor production lab that was funded by the Defense Department, more or less a creature of the federal government, Fairchild Semiconductors. Only then did he go to Intel. And at that point, the movement toward more private production of microchips had been pioneered basically by the federal government's massive investments. And later in his life, Grove talked a lot about how important it was to have this public investment in R&D, and more important, to train the next generation of scientists and engineers and computer entrepreneurs. It's been kind of forgotten that our most innovative industry really began with this massive public support. So you can go down the list. 18 of the 25 most important computing revolutions during the period in which we saw the greatest advance in computing technology were due to public investment. You know, the internet began essentially as the Defense Department's communications network, and the Defense Department tried to get private sector companies to take it on, but they thought it was too risky. And so this is a story that you see again and again, that often it takes public investment and public pressure to move into new domains of research and development, but then the private sector eventually picks up and starts to make its own vital role. And so that's, to me, a really good illustration of how important government is to productivity. Now, we're not making, I think, the investments we need to make in the next set of technological revolutions, whether it be the movement away from carbon-based energy or brain science and biochemical research. There has been a big slowdown in public investment in research and development. And more broadly, I think there's just a much greater resistance to the idea that the public sector could actually catalyze these important private sector developments and technologies. But that's exactly what we've seen again and again in our nation's history. And indeed, it's hard to identify any major technological revolution in the United States where government wasn't a central player in its genesis.
Jacob, we've run out of time for today, but thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is American Amnesia: How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. This is part one. We'll do part two next week. Thanks so much for being on Reader's Corner, Jacob.
Thank you so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to recent interviews anytime, anywhere, download our free app from the iTunes App Store or Google Play. Search for Reader's Corner.